The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to journey to Arizona first and also some other states to learn about the world of rattlesnakes. Yep, Love, Hate, and Rattlesnakes, an article written by Elizabeth Reut and appearing in the December 2024 issue of National Geographic. Before we begin the main article, I want to share a couple of sidebars that accompany the article. First, a caption from a photo on the introduction page. It says, "They've been revered as symbols of renewal. They've been reviled as emissaries of the underworld. They've been hunted and harassed into the dark corners of our imaginations. But can our fears be debunked before an icon of the American West disappears?" Now I want to read from a graphic called Range of the Rattler. It says, "More than 50 species of rattlesnakes live across North America. Found in a wide array of habitats, most species remain within 2 to 5 miles of their birth location their whole lives." Now, this graphic reveals that the rattlesnakes are no doubt found in a wide area, probably more than you and I may realize. Now, if you start with Texas, and we'll use that, kind of put that in your mind, the rattler stretches to the West Coast, then as far north as Oregon and Washington, and then into the Midwest, including Idaho and Montana, and some states south. Now, one species, the timber rattler, is found throughout the South and in several mid-Atlantic states, as well as the lower New York State area, along with Pennsylvania, Indiana, Illinois, and Michigan. Now, outside the continental U.S., rattlers also thrive in Mexico and parts of Central America. With that background in mind, let's join Elizabeth Reut as she takes us into the world of rattlers. And again, this is from this National Geographic. "The night of near-continuous rattlesnakes was mellow, the temperature pleasant, the humidity low, the beer cold. Under a crescent moon, the electric golf cart rolled silently over hilly paths. When our headlights illuminated a venomous snake, Matt Good would hop out, a drink in his right hand, a snake stick in his left, and calmly present the creature for my inspection. Unlike the amped-up fellows on YouTube snatching hissing vipers from beneath wooden boards, Good never shouted, 'Dude!' It was early September, and the herpetologist field season was winding up to a close. For over 20 years, the University of Arizona research scientist and his students have been capturing snakes, including western diamondback rattlesnakes, tiger rattlesnakes, and black-tailed rattlesnakes. They have found more than 7,000 so far on the cart paths of Oro Valley Stone Canyon Golf Course, just north of Tucson, and on the private roads dotted with multi-million-dollar homes that surround it. On the best nights, Good's team might bag up to 20 snakes. In a campus lab the next day, his students measure, sex, weigh, and mark them for recapture using paint on their rattles and inserting tiny microchips under their skin, then return them to their site of capture. Good's central research question, how does the ongoing conversion of pristine desert to housing development affect snakes? And it poses something of a conservation paradox. Compared with snakes in more natural areas, the Stone Canyon ones are growing larger, producing more offspring, and expanding their ranges among the McMansions. It helps, perhaps, that most homeowners are absent during the hottest months." As we rolled over a bridge past an artificial waterfall, Good exclaimed, "Look at this productivity. Thanks to irrigation, berries and blossoms abounded, attracting primary consumers such as the silky pocket mice that we saw scampering along the paths. On the lush fairways, our headlamps revealed a small herd of javelinas, members of the peccary family, and in a stand of trees, a retreating mountain lion." Now, Good had been seeing bobcats here, and coyotes and raccoons. Clearly, this was an Eden for snakes. They had plenty of rodents, birds, and eggs to eat, and the rocky outcrops styled by bulldozers provided plenty of places to hide. Good had placed informational signs here and there in an effort to curtail people's baser instincts, smashing rattlesnakes with golf clubs. But the nearby roads were occasionally greasy with flattened reptiles. You gotta ask, Good said with a sigh, is this development an ecological trap? How sustainable is it? The fate of all species is tied to anthropomorphic disturbances. A golf course could lose its water supply, for example, and half the birds could decamp. The one thing you can count on people to do, he said, is mess things up. The snakes of Stone Canyon may be doing well, but the fate of most other rattlesnakes, more than 50 species occur exclusively throughout the Americas, is grimmer. From southwestern Canada to central Argentina, people continue to capture them for pet or skin trade, swerve to flatten them as they warm themselves on roads, and chop up their habitat with subdivisions, pipelines, and cell towers. Timber rattlesnakes, once abundant, have been extirpated in a number of northern U.S. states and Ontario, and are threatened or endangered in pockets throughout their broad U.S. range. Several other species are categorized from generally threatened to critically endangered. I got a taste of how far conservationists will go to protect Pennsylvania's remaining timber rattlesnakes on a sunny late summer day. Sporting canvas snake gaiters, Thomas LeDuc, a herpetologist at East Stroudberg University, picked his way along the rocky ridgeline of Hawk Mountain, a 2,600-acre reserve that's wildly popular with birders during migration. When the brush to our right opened to a view of the valley below, we stepped off trail. Look, LeDuc said, nodding toward a rocky shelf of pink-gray conglomerate. Not 10 feet away, I discerned a thick pile of yellow and black coils. Somewhat incredulous, I crept infinitesimally closer, anticipating the characteristic sssst of a tail rattle. Nothing. This snake wanted only to bask. To my right, I saw another heap of snake. Female, said LeDuc, probably pregnant. Her head, like that of all rattlesnakes, was triangular, tapering quickly to a narrow neck. Her pupils were vertical, and the yellow and black chevrons down her spine looked as plush as velvet. As I stared, she slowly uncoiled, creating an uncanny illusion of moving in two directions at once, then disappeared into a crevice. LeDuc and I continued over the ridgeline, then descended to a talus field just below the heavily traveled trail. At first, I saw only rocks. Then, as before, I became aware of another reality. A coiled snake, the diameter of a fedora, on a prominent boulder. Then 6 feet away, another. Scanning the boulder field, careful to move only my eyeballs, I made out 6 more rattlesnake piles. Atop one, a clutch of neonates, khaki-colored with brown stripes, squirmed. Born just yesterday, LeDuc said. They already were more than 7 inches long and venomous, with hollow fangs and one tiny tail segment, called a button. Each time a rattlesnake sheds its skin, up to twice a year for adults, more often for the young, it gains another rattle segment. The rattles often fall off, so segments don't always reflect age. After a week of parental protection, behavior more often seen in mammals, the babies fend for themselves. They shed their skin for the first time, then may start following the trails of small animals, such as mice and shrews, using a scent-detecting organ at the roof of their mouth, known as the vomonasal organ, and heat-detecting organs inside small pits between their eyes and nostrils. They ambush their prey, inject a dose of highly toxic venom, then swallow their meal whole. As the weather cools, young rattlesnakes follow their mother's chemical trail back to the family's den, or the hibernaculum. They overwinter coiled with kin of all ages, including males returned from assignations with females up to 2 miles away, as well as other snakes such as racers and copperheads that might at other times prey on the rattlesnake offspring. During hibernation, snakes have no interest in eating. If they can't bask, they can't digest. LeDuc and his students radio-tagged and tracked timber rattlers for almost 3 years on Hawk Mountain, estimating their population size and pinpointing their most important hibernacula. Now, females, alongside newborns and subadults, spend most of their time basking, feeding, mating, and giving birth within several hundred yards of these underground lairs, and legions of bird-watching human visitors. At the time, LeDuc had recommended that the Hawk Mountain Sanctuary reroute its ridge trail to avoid this basking site, which it did. People picnic on these rocks, not knowing how close they are to snakes, LeDuc said. Nowadays, herpetologists consider the location of dens and basking sites state-level secrets. Some spend hours scouring social media, persuading enthusiasts posing with snakes to remove geotags from their Facebook and Instagram posts. It's great that people are interested in rattlesnakes, LeDuc said, but they don't realize the magnitude of their impact on the population. Persuading the public to protect venomous snakes can be difficult. Rattlesnakes have both fascinated and terrified us with their ability to remain hidden in their surprisingly strong bodies, needle-sharp fangs, and toxic venom. As biologist Edward O. Wilson has written, it pays in elementary survival to be interested in snakes. Humans' relationships with rattlesnakes have always been complicated. The Hopi of the U.S. Southwest considered them messengers of the rain-giving spirits of Earth and included rattlers in biennial rituals. The Aztec and Yucatec Maya of pre-Columbian Mesoamerica venerated rattlesnakes, linking them with rain and the planting season. According to one early 19th century account, some Western Cherokee felt an obligation to avoid killing rattlesnakes out of respect for their tightly knit family organizations. The Apache associated them with rebirth and renewal, while other Native American cultures linked them with violence and revenge. For early European colonists, rattlesnakes found only in the New World symbolized virility and fearlessness. In an infamous political cartoon from 1754 that urged colonial unity, the timber rattlesnake is separated into chunks representing the original British colonies. Under the snakes sit the words, "Join or Die." Later, rattlesnake and the motto, "Don't Tread on Me," were used on the Gadsden flag, which rallied the Continental Marines during the American Revolution. That flag, with a snake loosely coiled into a pyramid and ready to strike, has been brandished ever since by those with anti-government gripe. But reverence extends only so far. Through the 17th and 18th centuries, communities offered bounties for dead rattlers, a practice New York and Vermont continued into the 1970s. States organized, some still do, annual roundups that slaughtered hundreds, sometimes thousands of snakes in the name of safety. In the cold Northeast, where hundreds of timber rattlesnakes may overwinter in a single den, their mass exits in the spring made them particularly vulnerable to wholesale extermination. "I'm blue in the face from teaching people that snakes aren't out to get you," Madgood said as we hummed through Stone Canyon. He added, "But I don't know how much progress we've made. Throughout much of the South and Southwest, it's legal to kill many rattlesnake species, and some people kill a whole lot." Sweetwater, Texas, population 10,000, has held its rattlesnake roundup annually since 1958, when hunters extracted more than 3,000 pounds of western diamondbacks from their hideaways in the nearby countryside. Sponsored by the local JCs, a youth leadership group, the event continues to attract tens of thousands of visitors to Nolan County Coliseum and procures a yearly average of 5,800 pounds of live rattlesnakes. Some are collected on roadsides, but most are captured by hunters who cruise the state, busting up rocky cracks and crevices with crowbars and flushing their quarry from dens with aerialized gasoline. Eradication of a purported menace was the Sweetwater Roundup's founding goal, as it likely was the nation's 12 other roundups. But today its aim is unmistakably financial. The roundup buys snakes from hunters at a fluctuating per pound rate. It sends most of them to the Coliseum's cook shack, where they are dropped, beer battered into the fry pots, and sells the rest to vendors who will convert their skins into wallets, boots, purses, and trinkets. The three-day event raises cash for local charities between $63,000 or around $63,000 in 2023, and visitors annually inject over $8 million into the local economy. Karen Hunt, head of the local Chamber of Commerce, told a Texas newspaper that for many folks in Sweetwater, this is Black Friday. "This is what Black Friday is like for the snakes. Piled ankle-deep in octagonal wooden pens, they mostly remain coiled. Some rattle continuously, an indication they feel threatened. In the wild, these solitary predators may rattle just a few times in their entire lives. Many suffocate to death, and those with enough energy circle the perimeter of their pen, constantly searching for an exit. The air stinks of Reichgar deodorant sprayed to mask the snake's pungent musk, released in fear. Inside the milking pit, handlers squeeze yellowy venom from snake's fangs into a glass funnel atop a baby bottle. A filthy centrifuge sits nearby. What's the venom for? Drug research, a handler answers vaguely. According to longtime J.C. Milking Pit chairman Dennis Cumby, the Sweetwater Roundup sells large quantities of venom to private companies that make anti-venoms. But he won't reveal their names. In fact, companies that produce antivenoms or use venom for research either keep their own captive snake colonies or buy venom from zoos that collect it under sterile laboratory conditions. They inject this venom into large donor mammals like sheep or horses, which spurs the creation of antibodies that, distilled into antivenoms, are used to disable toxins in snake bite victims. Medical researchers are keenly interested in venom's hundreds of proteins and enzymes which attack blood cells, damage muscles, or destroy central nervous system. Researchers around the world are experimenting with venom-derived compounds that block or neutralize pain pathways, potentially offering an alternative to highly addictive opiates. Rattlesnake venom has been used to treat blood clots that occur deep inside veins and to develop drugs that lower blood pressure and stop heart attacks and strokes as they happen. In the education pit, handler David Sager, in a Stetson and tall boots, paces among dozens or so snakes, offering snake factoids and describing Western diamondbacks as mean, dangerous, and ugly, language that helps rationalize their persecution. With his snake stick, he prods animals into a coil, pins their heads, and lifts them for photos. He drops snakes to the floor, kicks them, and antagonizes a snake with a balloon until it strikes. Pop! The crowd, ranging from toddlers to retirees, gasp. If education is the curtain raiser, skinning is the Roundup's denouement. J.C.'s pin live snakes to a wooden block, then sever their heads with a single machete chop. Still writhing bodies are hung from a pole. Sometimes gallbladders are removed. They can fetch several dollars each and are used in traditional Chinese medicine. Then, for a $20 fee, visitors separate skin from sinew, anoint their palms with snake blood, and leave their red handprints on the wall. Even young children participate. I wander the dirt-floored Colosseum. The masked snakes look beaten down, stressed, possibly injured. If the Roundup is all about education, teaching the public that Western diamondbacks retreat from threats, hiss, and rattle in warning, strike enemies only as a last option. Bite venomously 25% of the time and are relatively easy to avoid. Why continue to stoke fear that results in a mass slaughter? According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, nationwide an average of 5 people a year die from venomous snake and lizard bites. While some snake hunters claim to be protecting livestock, which abound in West Central Texas, it's very rare to see cattle bitten by rattlesnakes, says veterinarian Bud Aldridge, Jr., who's been practicing in Sweetwater for 55 years, and bites are unlikely to be fatal. What explains the Roundup's persistence? Well, money, yes, but as Morehead State University's philosophy professor Jack Weir put it in a case study published by the journal Conservation Biology, Roundups are a way of continuing the excitement and adventure of the cowboy saga, proving one's manhood and identifying with local ethos. Though published in 1992, Weir's thesis appears to hold true today. I asked J.C. President Jimi Hendrix if his organization would consider switching to no-kill shows, as a few other Roundups have. To each his own, he answers, I understand people's point that, yeah, we're killing rattlesnake, but that's certainly not what we want to make a priority. It's what economically works for us. Do you think you'd get such a big crowd if you didn't kill the snakes? I don't know, he says. Western diamondbacks, which breed at a relatively young age, are not endangered in Texas, though the state's Park and Wildlife Department acknowledges it doesn't have any data from any specific populations anywhere in the state. Since 1958, hunters have delivered into the Sweetwater JCs more than 350,000 pounds of snakes, equivalent to about 70,000 rattlers. At a time when population of animal species globally have declined by an average of nearly 70%, wanton disregard for life in the absence of imminent threat to humans bothers Texas A&M University herpetologist Lee Fitzgerald. The roundups do send a twisted message, he says. They're not helping the way we think about biodiversity. We care about polar bears, but these snakes are worthless, he asks. Back home, I tried to forget what I'd seen in the skinning pit and focus on that afternoon on Hawk Mountain where Tom LaDuke and I had contemplated over a half dozen gestating or postpartum timber rattlers, large and peaceful, vital and venomous, as they glided in and out of the sun. Pennsylvania counties used to host their own Sweetwater-style rattlesnake roundups, LaDuke had told me. The festivals were hard to stamp out because they funded fire departments. But eventually, the State Fish and Boat Commission, which regulates hunting, inaugurated a paid permit system for live capture of rattlers and used the proceeds to fund community works. They recruited old snake hunters' survey populations, LaDuke said. They asked them for data, tagged the snakes at roundups, then returned them to their capture sites. As the population recovered, rattlers were removed from the state's endangered species candidate list. Nodding toward visitors toting binoculars along the Hawk Mountain ridgeline, LaDuke had asked rhetorically, why herpers, or at least those board flippers and tail grabbers notching likes on social media, couldn't be more like birders. Couldn't they count but not capture? I recall that Hawk Mountain, before being set aside as a bird refuge, was a popular site for shooting goshawks, which carried a $5 bounty. Goshawks prey on game animals such as rabbits, grouse, and ducks. So maybe there was hope. It's a mental shift, LaDuke said. First you're a hunter, then an illegal poacher, and then, with a little bit of education, you're someone who helps another species survive. Wow. Well, perhaps snakes are not on your must-visit list. How about cats? We just have the article for you, if you like feline companionship. Why Cats Make Great Sailors is the article. It's written by Scott Christensen and appeared in the December 2024 issue of National Geographic. And as the introductory caption reads, they famously detest water but have been fixtures on ships since the dawn of seafaring. So, are you ready to sail? Let's do so. They had names such as Tom, Terror, Wackle, Bounce, Dirty Face, and Bilgewater. They traveled thousands of miles on the most storied warships with some of history's saltiest sailors. They were valued members of the crew, even issued custom miniature uniforms for photographs and their own tiny hammocks for catnapping. They were the cats that served in the world's navies. Ship cats are not a recent phenomenon. They have been serving on ships for almost as long as humans have been going to sea. Ancient Egyptian tomb paintings depict them hunting from boats sailing down the Nile, and cats made their way across the Mediterranean aboard Phoenician and Greek trading vessels. Cats' hunting prowess on land made them valuable companions at sea. Rodent infestations caused major problems on ships as rats and mice contaminated and consumed food stores, chewed through equipment, and spread disease. Cats were a cheap and effective solution to the vermin, and they were also good company. On long voyages, they could provide a vessel's crew with a morale boost in the form of much-needed affection and a bit of softness in the Spartan environment of a ship. Since cats were considered mascots to be shared by all the sailors, they also helped create bonds among the crew. Perhaps not surprisingly, sailors developed plenty of superstitions around feline behavior. Seamen preparing to sail considered it good luck when cats chose to board their vessels. But it was a dreadful sign indeed when a cat decided to jump ship. An even worse omen, the sight of two cats fighting on a pier, which could be forewarning that those setting sail could perish or would perish. Some early mariners believed that cats could control the weather with their tails. Twitching them in a certain manner meant that the cats were angry and preparing to unleash a violent storm. Sailors later realized that cats twitched their tails when they were agitated by a sudden drop in air pressure, indicating that the ship would soon face unfavorable weather. Crews began to monitor all the mannerisms of their ship's cats and viewed any unusual behavior as a storm warning. The felines were, in a sense, little fairy barometers. Though cats are known for their aversion to water, their biology makes them surprisingly suited to life at sea. Unlike sailors such as the Limeys of the Royal Navy, who famously drank citrus juice to prevent scurvy, cats can make their own vitamin C and therefore survive on a diet that lacks fruit and vegetables. Now, cats also are able to obtain most of the water they need from their prey, so they do not require a lot of potable water as human sailors do. In addition, cats have an excellent internal filtration system that allows them to drink a bit of seawater if necessary. Throughout the so-called Age of Discovery, cats were a mainstay on European vessels and even played a role in the insurance protocols of the day. Legal codes published in Valencia, Spain in 1494 held the patron of a vessel responsible for any damage done to merchandise by rats if he had neglected to provide for online feline protection. If the cats were on board, then the patron was in the clear. Into the 20th century, cats remained fixtures on ships. In the United Kingdom, one of the earliest and largest cat rescue programs occurred during the First World War, when thousands of strays were rounded up in cities and given to the military. The cats supplied to the Royal Navy even received a weekly victualling allowance of 1 shilling and 6 pence to pay for treats from the ship's canteen. A large U.S. Navy vessel would be home to as many as 24 cats. Some prowled the galley and grew fat, while others preferred the bowels of the ship, where they could find refuge from the loud sounds of a ship's guns. Cats have a reputation for being notoriously difficult to train, but some sailors claim to have learned to speak cat and were able to get their mascots to perform feats such as standing at attention, saluting, walking, tight ropes, and ringing bells. This especially contributed to the U.S. Navy's goodwill efforts in foreign ports when locals were invited for ship tours that included a brief show featuring performing cats. The friendliest felines were happy to stay in the berthing area where they received plenty of attention from sailors. They would also sleep in hammocks that reduced the sensation of swaying felt aboard a boat. After all, ship cats could get just as seasick as humans. Following the end of the Second World War, the special position that cats held on Navy ships began to decline in the United States. Improvements in fumigation and pest control made them somewhat redundant as chief mousers, and some commanding officers even viewed them as extractions. But the bigger problem for cats in the U.S. Navy lay in the public relations. In the immediate post-World War II era, members of Congress were looking to enact deep defense cuts, including the Navy's budget. To make a point about inefficiency, legislators revealed one ship had staffed a 3-man committee to plan a funeral for their mascot cat. The example was misleading. The true cost of keeping cats to maintain morale were nominal and often paid by the crews themselves. But the charge of frivolous spending nonetheless embarrassed Navy brass. More than anything, the long run of the ship cat was ended by stricter international quarantine laws imposed after the war. Recognizing cats are a natural escape artist, the Navy wanted to avoid having its captains involved in legal and diplomatic dust-ups due to curious feline trying to circumvent a quarantine. So current U.S. Navy policy does not explicitly ban cats on ships, but the special permission sailors now need to bring a feline friend on board is almost never granted. And by the way, most navies of the world have adopted a similar policy, except for Russia. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of today's journey of Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please direct them to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.